The Cork-born actress Fiona Shaw is considered one of the finest performers on both the Irish and English stage. Some of her most notable roles include Medea, Hedda Gabler, Miss Jean Brodie, and more controversially, Richard II. She has won numerous honours, including 3 Olivier Awards and a New York Critics Award for her performance in T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Last Thursday, Fiona Shaw gave the opening speech at the Irish Theatre Forum's annual conference. She spoke to me afterwards about the conference, her work and her views on Irish theatre. She was introduced at the conference by her friend, the artist Dorothy Cross. Dorothy also sat in on the interview. But first I asked Fiona about her views of the conference theme, ripping up the script.
Well, luckily I didn't know that actually before I arrived, but I would never tear up the script. But maybe that's all the better to have somebody who wouldn't tear up the script start a conference about tearing up the script. I think they're talking about how to get outside the page or beyond the page. But today in my comments, I was focusing very much on how important the script was and how it's fundamentally the great guide to the theatre in the two islands of England and Ireland, because we have this fantastic language that we all participate in, be it Hibernian English or English English, but that there's a poetic capability in that language that supersedes pretty well any other language.
So when you're performing, say, a role like Medea, you stick strictly to the script, but your characterisation can go anywhere, can it not?
Well, of course, that would be in gruesome translation, being from the Greek, but so I don't know what it would be in the Greek, in which case it would be probably very strict in the Greek. But the moment you go into translation, really the play leaves its, you know, its fundamental poetic meaning and becomes a kind of free-for-all. But I would normally be very, very true to the script in that I find that the more true you are to scripts, the more chaos or the more atavistic you can find the intention underneath the script. I was fascinated by, I didn't mention this today, but I was thinking about Oscar Wilde, you know, that you have Cicely and Gwendolyn in The Importance of Being Earnest saying, you know, tea or bread and cake or bread and butter. You know, cake is rarely served in the best houses nowadays. And at the time that Oscar Wilde was writing that, he was at his most sexually predatory. And it's so interesting that somebody would go home in the afternoon from a debauched evening and write entirely gentle language about tea and cake and bread and butter. And somehow I think all theatre is merely enacting out the carapace of formality that hides the abyss of chaos that lies underneath it. And that's the excitement of it. And playing with the explosive potential of that is really what the theatre is about.
You've said at one stage, Fiona, that theatre is dangerously open to repetition. Do you find that Irish theatre at the moment, or are you familiar with the what's on in the stage in Ireland at the moment? Do you find it repetitious or new?
I haven't kept up with the theatre, to my shame, lately in Ireland. But I think that it's a danger for any theatre. And the only way that you can protect yourself from it is to have very long rehearsal periods on plays that are very difficult to do, so that the bar is set very high for the actors, so that the challenge for the actors nightly is so strong that they have to, like athletes, you know, jump that high jump every night so that they don't feel repetitious. And repetitious is merely that they get used to doing a certain thing. They should never get used to it. It should always be almost too hard for them nightly. But I think when it's like that, it's never repetitious.
You're lucky in the sense that as an actor, you work with the director or you work with other actors. You've done a lot of work with Deborah Warner, for example. How does she help you realise your art or your craft?
Well, I think if you work with somebody over a long period of time, you just have a shorthand, and that's useful. It's terribly useful if you get into tricky waters and you are with somebody who's navigated those waters before. It doesn't make it easier, but it makes you trust the lostness. So that we recently did Happy Days together at the National Theatre, and it was really terrible to rehearse because it's a fragmented piece of text that has no common ground really for anybody, because that's Beckett's intention, to take away any pylons of security that, you know, Winnie, the character I was playing, has any access to. So I found it very hard to rehearse because there was nothing to stand on. Literally, you're in quicksand all the time, as Winnie is. And Deborah was in despair too, but I've seen that despair before. So the familiarity of despair gave me a kind of confidence that meant that we might get to the other side of the desert. That was all.
You also work as a film actor, and you've spoken of cinema before as saying that Hollywood tends to create good stories, smarmy, smooth, sweet stories, and it's kind of very reluctant to take on the tragedy. And you feel that tragedy is important in life, don't you?
I think tragedy is absolutely what we need, yeah. I think without tragedy, we don't know where we are. And it's not because tragedy makes us sad. It actually releases us from our sadness that we already have. The problem with comedy is that it is a wonderful thing and entirely necessary and perhaps the most dexterous thing theatrically that we have got. Very good comedies are very hard to make. But with tragedy, the sense of sympathy and empathy that humans can have for each other is contacted. Stories which are full of horror in domestic lives are accentuated in tragedy, and so people can feel better, actually, rather than worse. And tragedy purifies the community and allows us to understand that to be human is to be flawed, and that that's okay too.
While I have you here, I suppose I must ask you about Richard II. That created consternation when you originally produced it. Were you happy you did that project?
Retrospectively, I'm incredibly proud of it. I think at the time, I had no idea that you only had to leave the received notions of what plays are meant to be. In fact, that production was very rigorous, in many ways quite conservative. There was a mass composed that went right through it. There was the kind of blossom of the best of English actors, both upper range and middle range actors that you could wish for, who played the various lords. And the only revolutionary aspect of it was that I was in the centre of it, playing Richard II. But it caused a much greater stir. It was sort of nuclear, what happened. And at the time, I felt very uncomfortable in it for the obvious reason that I wasn't as sure that I was standing on sure ground, because to leave your gender behind is to leave your history behind. And I kept on thinking, I'm really, you know, standing on false legs here. But years later, I think it was something that showed that the theatre must not be about, ever, the history of the country you're living in, but must be about an act of imagination. And the fact that it stuck makes me feel that it was fundamentally that. It was nothing to do with politics owning the history of Richard II. Shakespeare wrote a play called Richard II, and one can do whatever one likes with that. And I feel equally strongly about that 10 years later.
Traditionally in theatre, women didn't act at all. In Shakespeare's time, there was no women in theatre.
And a good thing too, I think. no, they didn't. And they seem to be annoyingly coming into their own, these women. But they didn't. But they, and still a strange thing's happening. Actually, funny enough, there's been an enormous resurgence of all-male companies. And there isn't in any way a resurgence of female companies. And in that way, I think there's a massive sort of sexual politic at play, which is that women dressing as men still remains a sort of an abomination, whereas men dressing as women has permission due to the history of plays, and also has a sort of humorous overtone which delights audiences for all sorts of reasons that I'm not clever enough to work out. But it does seem that that inequality persists. I have to say on behalf of both genders that they have every right to break the barrier if they can make it work. I think it's Mark Rylance last year played Cleopatra at the Globe, and he was beyond fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And he played Olivia in Twelfth Night. So it can be revelatory when, funny enough, the outsider steps in to play something that is known. And that happens in lots of ways. Often outsider actors from other countries throw a lot of light on the behaviour of a country. I mean, we may find that the next Plough in the Stars is best done by Polish immigrants. You know, there are slants, which is what I think Dorothy would say art is about, this slanting towards reality that often releases the meaning of it. So being too centred, I'm all for little revolutions in the theatre, because they throw different light on things. If they work, they have to work, and there's nobody can tell you why they work. They just work or they don't.
In this modern day and age of multimedia and computers and laptops and portable televisions and the whole thing, where is theatre?
Well, you must tell me that, Poike. your finger's on the button there. I think it's where it's always been, which is probably in a state of flux, because the world is in a state of flux. So the theatre does, there's no doubt, react to what's going on. A healthy theatre. I mean, somebody said to me tonight, just at the conference, said, actually, people now in the theatre just want very glamorous events that they can dress up to and go to. Well, that's what the theatre was in the 18th century, when people were rich and looked beautiful and made the theatre themselves. I'm not sure I'm against that. If that's what they feel, they must go to the theatre dressed up and show off, and that's fine. At another time, a political theatre will rise up and people can wear, you know, shabby anoraks and go to the theatre. So it's undoubtedly connected to the spirit of the time. And at the moment in Ireland, obviously, wealth, sophistication and excitement about self is a big thing. And I think the theatre has just to accommodate that.
This is the Irish Theatre Forum. This is the forum of the people producing theatre in Ireland. Were they excited? Were they pulsed about the future? Was there a buzz about the conference?
Well, I think I was surprised about two things. One was that the amount of administrators there is fantastic, and the amount of people dealing with the many arts attached to the theatre. What is equally surprising is that there are very few actors at this conference, and I thought that was a sad thing, because I think all of the theatre should turn up in force for itself. And it may be significant that actors don't feel that they belong at such a conference, but I think they really, really do, because the future of the Irish theatre lies in the training of young actors that really allows them to feel that they have the machinery with which to deal with whatever is going to come at them in the future. And I think the position of the theatre itself would be healthier if it's more communal between the actors and those who would manage them, rather than, you know, two separate worlds. So I'm hoping that that gap will be realised this year, and that next year I really do hope that they will be all together much more.
Did the traditional, or does the traditional patriarchal nature of the theatre manifest itself at the Irish Theatre Forum? Was it all in?
Not yet. We'll find out at the barbecue tonight.
The keynote speaker was a woman, Pádraig.
Sorry?
The keynote speaker was a woman.
That's just tokenism.
Yeah, that's true.
You're trying to stir things up here, Pádraig, Brendan.
No, it seems very, very welcoming altogether.
But Dorothy, you had the privilege of introducing Fiona to the conference. What did you say?
Well, I introduced her because I'm a great admirer of her work, and We've recently attempted two works together, actually. We nearly made a piece of work called Monte Notte on an island in Cork Harbour, and we nearly did an opera in London.
What's so special about two Monte Notte ladies making an opera?
Well, that's two separate things. One is that we were actually not going to make an opera. We were going to make a sort of, I daren't say the word installation because Dorothy will have a fit, but we were going to sort of do an event on Spike Island, which is in the middle of Cork Harbour, where we were going to use fragments of our memories, bits of film, bits of ideas, theatrical events, and make a sort of happening. But we could never quite gain the permission for it for 2005, when Cork was the city of culture. But it didn't quite happen. But a lot of the stuff still exists, so we're hoping to do it yet.
The title of the piece was Monte Notte, which means Night Mountain in Italian, and is the breakdown of our home neighbourhood.
Well, you're both from Monte Notte, are you not?
We are.
And did you know each other when you were growing up? Or?
We did.
We did.
It's absolutely in sync now when we sing it for it.
And this collaboration, this Monte Notte, the Night Mountain, what interests you about that, Fiona?
Well, you know, I wanted to step outside this thing of texts that I normally do, and the Cork 2005 put Dorothy and I together to see if we could come up with something. And I think Dorothy thought it was an opportunity, given that we both were away, because she thinks so brilliantly conceptually that she just says very obvious, direct things, that we're both away from where we were from. The place we're from is unique in that it is dying. In itself, it's dying, because it's a place that grew with the Napoleonic expectation that never happened in Cork. So it's full of grain barons' houses, beautiful views over a river that is now nearly industrialised, and the city of Cork. And it's both 19th century and 20th century all mixed up. And in fact, anybody living there sort of lives in the 19th century. And I think it was just to throw a lasso around that for a moment, to have a look back at what it is that our parents lived in, as opposed to what she and I now choose to live in, which is the modern world, I hope. I mean, she'd probably be better about it than that. But that was the starting off point, I think.
But I think the finding of the location of Spike Island was fantastic, because it's a wonderful island in the middle of Cork Harbour that's kind of ignored. And for us, symbolically, it was almost like this landing place to return to, because we no longer are from Cork in a way. And physically, the place is so wonderful. You know, it has a prison, which we weren't going to work in. It had a house called Bleak House. It had an old soccer pitch, a gun house, a bathing house and a graveyard with a view of Camden and Carlisle Forts. You know, it was an ideal location. And I think it showed an immense lack of imagination by the powers that be when they refused to give us permission to use it.
You spoke, Fiona, about when you were doing Medea, that it challenged your very sanity.
Did I?
Well, I read it.
it must be true. It probably did. I mean, what really threatens people's sanity, I think, in the theatre is the hard work of it, is that the amount of hours spent, if you never get out and see daylight, you go a bit insane in the end. Funnily enough, doing Medea, one of the great things about it, particularly by the time we got to America, is that we used to play a ball game, the whole group of us making it. And we got obsessed with this ball game. We used to play it every night at 6 o'clock until 7 o'clock before we got ready. And it became a fantastic unifying thing and full of laughter and joy. And I think without that, we would have gone insane, that the amount of fun necessary in order to put on a tragedy is massive. And you need to absolutely play into those opposites. You know, you have to find the humour in things. You have to be light about it. And I think that's how we kept ourselves very sane.
What makes going on stage so attractive, so powerful?
Gosh, I don't know, but except that it's only powerful if you know or think you know what it is that you might be trying to do. I think it's dialogue, actually. It's this feeling that you're in conversation with. So, you know, there's no point in going on an empty stage, and there's no point in going on a stage unprepared. I think if you're prepared, that you're offering a gift, or think it's a gift, to an audience, and that they take the gift and respond to it. It's the best of what humans can do for each other. It's a very high voltage feeling of communication and, strangely, redemption. It's as if that we can all redeem each other if we all play different roles within it. It's a very elevated feeling, I have to say.
There's another medium, Fiona, radio drama. Do you like that medium?
I love it. I think it's actually one of the great mediums, actually. It's a wonderful, wonderful medium. You can, you know, say anything on the radio. You can say, I am invisible, or you can say, you know, I'm going to now walk through the door and I'm going to be in Istanbul. I mean, it's a fantastic medium, isn't it? Without any cost. It's very near reading, I suppose. I have a great respect for it.
Again, I suppose it's been neglected in some ways. You know, people have moved on. Unless it's visual, unless it's fast, unless it's immediate, it hasn't got the same power. And theatre is suffering the same thing. Theatre isn't fast enough, immediate enough for the modern day world, I think.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I do think you're right about, I mean, all sorts of things are happening. Novels are becoming shorter. Plays are becoming shorter. Theatre plays are becoming shorter. And you can't underestimate, if you do theatre plays, I did King Lear before Christmas on the radio in England, and it's playing to millions, literally millions of ears, which you'd never get in the theatre. So I think the shrinking of the audiences in the theatre is a real big worry, but I think inevitable at the moment. I think people are high on their own personal financial success, and they won't need the theatre until they need it. But I think if we wait on long enough, they'll need it again.
It's great to hear somebody optimistic about the future of theatre.
I am, because people have always been rather pessimistic about it, and actually it does seem to struggle on.
It does seem to struggle on. Even the Middle Ages didn't get it, you know.
Yes, and I think in Ireland, actually, this is a fantastic moment, because, you know, it's wonderful having Fiac running the Abbey. It's wonderful having this feeling of a new wave of things happening. The Trinity course has sadly come to an end, but has allowing a whole new debate about how to train modern Irish actors. All of this is going to come to pass, I hope, in a very, very good way.
Fiona Shaw, Dorothy Cross, thank you very, very much for being with us on the 11th Hour.
Thank you.